Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. And she uses all of these skills to address the problems that we all grapple with in this conversation with the reluctant therapist. Happy Healthy Tuesday, Elizabeth.
Happy Healthy Tuesday, Brad.
And where are we off to today?
Well, if I had to be perfectly honest, I say that I'm a little bit distracted because Friday night I'm giving a TED talk at the San Luis Obispo TEDx conference. And so those thoughts are really dominating my head. And it's interesting because I talk for a living here and lecturing at school. And so you would think that I would just throw out a topic and it'd be great. But this is different because it's timed and it's more scripted and it's wanting to condense everything I know about mental health into 15 minutes. And so my mind is spinning with that a bit. So that's where I am. But for today, in this spot, I've been thinking a lot about communication, which kind of aligns with the TED Talk and doing these conferences. But there's kind of three other pieces to it that all come together. So just follow along. First, I have a full-on guilty pleasure for General Hospital, which is a soap opera, if you might not know them. And again, if I were to be perfectly honest, when they were on, there was a time that I did know the storyline of All My Children, One Life to Live, and General Hospital, and could have popped in any time. I actually saw my first episode of All My Children when I was in third grade and I was homesick from school. And for those of you who never watched it, this won't mean much. For those of you who did, you'll get exactly where I am. But this was at the time when Erica Kane was dating a young man who was sent to Vietnam to fight in the war. And it was so tragic. It was like real time happening. So I remember that. And it's kind of been my relationship summarizes is not sitting and watching every minute, but it's been kind of these stories that have been there in the background of my life as I've lived my life. And when I had my girls and, you know, the nursing schedule when they were babies just kind of hit. And so I looked forward to it. And the lives of these people just kind of wandered along. And it was like TV friends and their life and my life. And so that's one piece of it. And in the world of soap operas, the most problematic thing for me is that they mess things up so quickly, and it would be so easy to solve so many of the issues if they could just communicate with each other. And so I find myself, the older I get especially, the less patience I have, it's like, how can we continue having the same story where someone says something that's misconstrued and then they have an affair with their neighbor the next day and then the person runs over and said, I'm sorry for what I said, and it's like too late, I already had an affair. It's like, wait a second, that is so not true. But then I was thinking about it more deeply because the other thing that's going on, the other kind of non-sequential or piece of the thoughts is that I have been encountering a lot of people who are struggling with communication issues in their relationships. Whatever that is, at work, at school, a lot of my students are having roommate communication relationships. Friends are struggling with communication issues in their marriages. It's a lot. And when I listen to how the communication has gone awry or why they're struggling, I can't help but in the back of my mind think, ooh, this is a little bit like soap opera communication problems, that you're communicating things not in the most clear ways, hoping that the person is going to read your mind and get the message. And then you're vastly disappointed when they misconstrue what you've said and now an argument ensues over and over and over again. And so I was wondering, maybe we're not that far in real life from communicating like soap operas, and maybe the only difference is we don't instantly run off and have an affair with our neighbor. But then I would argue I just might not know those people who are actually doing that. That communication is so precarious, and our ability to really sit and own what we feel and what we need and be able to translate that to others is really way more challenging, I think, than we often realize. And if you talk to couples who get divorced, more often than not, they're going to say we had a breakdown in communication, irreconcilable differences, which can only mean we didn't know how to speak with each other. And when you look at the trajectory of marriages, and this is another piece of the story, pulling it all together, couples who come in for counseling or end up getting divorced and talk about their irreconcilable differences, and that, again, code for not being able to communicate, it's not necessarily the fights, because it's easy to look at the fights. We fought too much, or we fought about the same things, or things that couples really argue about and get angry about. Like, you can address that. It's tangible. It's like, we fought too much, or you never listen to what I say, or you always countered everything I felt was important. Like, those arguments we can get. But it's the unspoken, it's the nonverbal communication that I think really destroys and undermines marriages. For example, if you have a spouse who enjoys flowers. I'm trying to think of an example that has nothing to do with my life or anyone I know, so I don't get into trouble. If you have a spouse that enjoys getting flowers, and so as the husband, you think, I'm going to take my wife flowers because I love her so much. And so you continue to bring daisies. You know, every month I bring you daisies. And at some point, your loving wife says, I want a divorce. I hate you. And the husband is so shocked. It's like, what do you mean? How did we get here? I love you. I bring you daisies every few weeks to show my love to you. And then the wife says, I hate daisies. And I've been telling you that for 20 years. I like roses. And every time you bring me daisies, it's as if you're saying, I don't care about you. And so we often wonder how relationships get into trouble, because we go over in our head, what did I say? What did they say? Right? How did I react? How did they react? But what we don't really pay attention to is what was the nonverbal piece of that argument or discussion that I didn't pay attention to. Like, did I look down at my phone while we were in the middle of the discussion, which broke the concentration? Did I offer to make dinner, but it was a meal that my husband hates? And so I'm subtly, right? Sending those nonverbal messages. And then the last piece of all of my thoughts this week goes to Siblings Day, National Siblings Day, which was Sunday, this last Sunday. It's always on April 10th, whatever day of the week that falls on. And so it happened to be this Sunday. I didn't really know it was a thing, but I did see a lot of pictures popping up on social media. And so I was thinking about my two siblings, Jamie and Katie. I'm the oldest. My brother is about 18 months younger than I am. And then my sister Katie is 9 years younger than I am, almost 10. And we're very close. I will say that with a lot of pride, that we are very close. And part of the reason that we're close is that our parents said we needed to be. Which I think is a really good parenting plan, because I don't know if enough parents stress how important it is to hang with your siblings, because sibling relationships are as fraught with challenges as marriages and as soap operas. And a lot of sibling arguments are right in there in soap opera fodder. But as we were growing up, my parents had moved from the East Coast to the West Coast when we were very young, very, very young. And so they were out here kind of on their own. And so from the time we got here, my dad said, this is your team. This is all you've got in the world. And so you better make sure that you look out for each other. And I think that really helped, because it wasn't as if we were instant besties. My brother and I were not instant besties. We're so close in age that we really fought and fought and fought and just constantly were at each other with very different personalities. But we both went to UC Santa Barbara. I was a year and a half ahead of him. And when we got there, our whole relationships changed, because we got to interact with each other outside of home. And so I'm really curious about how these relationships, our closest blood ties, can get so toxic and so difficult to navigate. And in a world that's already so complex and moving at lightning speed and already feeling alienating and lonely, that we could really use those most closely knit relationships to hold us together. So today, I thought we would visit those topics about siblings and our relationships with them, talk about communication in those relationships and how they become challenging and actually how we can make them better, and anything else that pops up around the world of challenging conversations and communication. Because I think it's something we all work on, think about, grapple with. So we'll be opening up the phone lines today because it's just me and Brad. So we'd love to have you join us as well with a comment or a question. Our number is 805-781-3875. You can also be part of the conversation by giving us a call and asking a question to Brad, because you don't have to go on the air. But I will side note this. If we're working on our communication skills, it would be awesome practice to actually go on the air and ask the question, because those things that scare us the most about communication, we probably should actually do. So you may call and ask Brad to ask the question, but I really encourage you to call and ask the question or make the comment yourself. 805-781-3875. You can also follow us on Instagram or Facebook, The Reluctant Therapist. You can podcast our show by going wherever you get your podcasts and look for A Conversation with The Reluctant Therapist. Hit subscribe, leave a review, and then other people will be able to find the show. You can listen to previous shows also by visiting kcbx.org. Brad gets those shows posted quickly so you can listen to all the previous shows. And you can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. So I'm glad you're here today. Can't wait to hear what you have to say. We're going to take a quick break and come back and continue our conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
Like sweet morning dew, I took one look at you, and it was plain to see you were my destiny.
With arms open wide, I threw away my pride. I'll sacrifice for you, dedicate my life to you. I'll go where you lead.
Come on, baby.
Always there in time of need.
I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. All right, so we're going to communicate about communication, which is in the professional world called metacommunication, which means communicating about what we're communicating about. And the main secret about successful communication is that we can bypass a lot of misunderstandings if we take the time before we speak to share our intentions, which may seem kind of strange. It's like a precursor or preview of what we're actually going to have a conversation about, or maybe to share what our intentions are. So, for example, if you were having a conflict about what to do this weekend, and before you started the conversation, you said, I want to talk about this weekend, but I want you to know that whatever we do, I really enjoy spending time with you, and so I'm willing to compromise or work it out, but my goal ultimately is to get to spend some time with you because that's important to me. Just by taking that 30 seconds, 15 seconds to explain what your intentions are can actually start to lower the bar of conflict right away. And you can apply that to any conversation that you're going to have with a friend or an intimate partner, someone that you care deeply about. So before we jump in too far, Brad, I'll just start with you. Because siblings, sibling relationships are considered our closest blood ties, but they also, our siblings, can be people that we don't even recognize as being related to us. They can be so different in personality and interests. But it's not just that. It's also this idea of sibling rivalry, which is real. It exists. And it's very primal and evolutionary that parents, 150 years ago had to make sometimes tough decisions about which children they're going to invest medicine or time in because they didn't have the resources to make sure all children thrived. And in the 1800s, less than half of all children made it to adulthood. So there is kind of that real evolutionary truth that when children come into the world, they're in some ways competing with their siblings for parental attention and for their own survival. But of course, we've in many ways moved past that, but this sense that we're in competition with our siblings for our parental approval is still a real thing. And so we end up tending to have kind of this mix of sibling relationships. Some people will say they're really tight, really close, get along great. And other people say it's a battle all the way across the board. Some I haven't spoken to in years. So what is your sibling story?
My sibling story is one of, I was basically an only child until I was 10. And then my parents delivered a brother, baby brother to me. And he's been my only brother, which is in the subsequent years, because our parents died very young. And so in the subsequent years, our relationship has evolved, you know, from a strictly sibling relationship to even by his own admission to somewhat of a parental type mm-hmm. of relationship as well. Even though we didn't, you know, live together for a long time, by the time I was ready to move out, he was just about, you know, 8 or 9 years old. So on one hand, we both had benefits of kind of having the house to ourselves, as it were, for a significant period of time. But it did make communication later on rather difficult. And we went through many years where we were both struggling with different things in our lives separately and trying to find our own way. And it was really only after a certain point where we had some communication and I basically said, look, these periods of not talking to each other for 2-3 years at a time, that's really great when you're in your 20s and your 30s. But, you know, we're not getting any younger, and I would hate to see us lose that communication. And thankfully, over the last few years, he and his family relocated to this area. We made a lot of strides in repairing our relationship, enjoying each other's company, and making that reconnection. Although there are always those little communication landmines and things that you have to try to work out. But it was only after a period of a lot of non-communication that we both made the decision that we needed to sit down, talk it through, and make sure that we were connecting together.
The woman who founded National Siblings Day, and again, I was surprised that it was a day, her name is Claudia Evert, and she was from New York City, and she lost both of her siblings at a really young age, and she never got to say goodbye to either one of them. And so this really haunted her for years and years. And of course, when she would talk to people who hadn't spoken to their siblings for years, this really ate at her. It's like, why would you squander those years and those relationships? So she founded National Siblings Day to encourage people to reach out and reconnect with siblings, you know, in any way that they could. And, you know, the kind of the trajectory of the sibling story is when you're young, you're competing for parental attention. Siblings tend to each unconsciously find their niche in the family system. So the oldest, you know, tends to be more parentified, tend to be the real go-getters, type A. They tend to be more neurotic than the other siblings because they're the practice children and also just being oldest. But they also tend to be world leaders. All the astronauts were oldest children. It's kind of this real go-getter personalities. The part of the oldest sibling, which always makes me cringe a little bit, but I'll own it, is that most oldest children have a really hard time recognizing that there might be another view or another viewpoint in a conversation because they're so used to being the oldest and need to be right. And then those middle children, and so the oldest will find kind of their niche. Maybe they're really smart, or they're great athletes, or they're a great musician. You know, they get first pick or first, you know, way into that their talent or that thing that makes them shine. And then the second child, you know, is now in competition. And so they tend to try to find, not consciously but unconsciously, their own place where they shine. So if the older sibling is a great scholar, then they might really shine as an athlete or in music or in some other way, and to just kind of set themselves apart. They also tend to be, you know, a little more balanced because they get to see all the ways that the older sibling, you know, struggles. And then if there's a third sibling, now you've created this middle child. And so when a second child becomes a middle child, quite often they will say, I never got as much love as anyone else. I never got enough attention. I always felt left out because there was an oldest and a baby and they were just kind of forgotten. But then it also frees up that middle child to go out and explore the world because they're not the focus of parental attention that the oldest and the baby might be. And so they tend to be more connected to their peer groups and their friend groups. They tend to be more apt to settle in a different state or a different area than the other siblings. And so while middle children can feel lost and kind of left out, they also have a lot of freedom of expression and movement that the other siblings don't. And then for that third child or the baby of the group, because you know, for four children, you have two middle children. But for the baby of the family, the youngest, they have the benefit of learning again from their older siblings' mistakes, and they tend to become very good manipulators. Youngest of the families tend to be very good salespeople because they learn to work the room. They also develop their humor, their sense of humor. And if you look at comedians, a lot of comedians were the babies, youngest of their families. Because they get a lot of attention from the whole family. So they have a built-in audience. And then they, you know, kind of trade on their humor because they don't have the size of the other siblings to fight the battle. So then they either whine a lot to get parental attention or they use humor. And so you have kind of these niche places, niche roles that the siblings play in their family system. And then that, you know, kind of takes them into elementary school or grade school when the siblings start to split off and make relationships outside of kind of their family system, but then with their peer groups.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I can say in my own circumstance that the connective tissue between my sibling and myself, which was the source of connection and rivalry as we've gotten older, is music, because it's been kind of a through line that's been passed down through the generations in our family. Even though we weren't explicitly, outwardly musical people, it was in the background. And so my uncle, my mom sang, my uncle played guitar, taught me how to play guitar. My kid brother used to come and sit in with me when he was 9 or 10, and his determination was to be better than me. And that's exactly what he did, and he's a fabulous singer and guitar player and musician. But there is a remnant of that competition that still goes on, and it's in a funny place in our regard. And you were talking earlier about talking to people about collecting things or having certain items. Mm-hmm. We are in an escalating war over who can die with the most guitars in our closet. And so he's never going to win that competition. But I recognize that it is that little bit of sibling rivalry coming into play, even though we're both, you know, old guys now.
Grown-ups. Yeah. Well, and as I said, usually siblings will find their own niche. But yes, there are times when two siblings will be competing for that same stardom, either as, you know, both great intellects or students and or maybe athletes in the same sport. That also does happen, which can really cause a lot of sibling rivalry. And sometimes intentionally or unintentionally, parents will create that sibling rivalry by putting children in the same sports or the same activities, which kind of sets up naturally this competition. If you're just tuning in, this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And today we're talking about communication within our families, within our relationships. And because Sunday was National Siblings Day, how our relationships are with our siblings, how we get along, how we find peace with each other. And I'd love to have you be part of the conversation. Our number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. So talking about kind of the trajectory of the relationship with our siblings, once we get into grade school, elementary school, into high school, we start to be a little more other focused. And so we tend to, you know, kind of split a bit from our siblings. And then we get into our lives as adults. And then we really see our relationships kind of change because our focus becomes whatever our relationship status is or raising our own children. And then there's all of the drama 100 times over of how you celebrate the holidays and who's going to show up and who's going to bring what. And, you know, part of the reason I was thinking about the show this week is that we have Easter Sunday coming up, and it's a really big gathering for our family. So we kind of have let go of other Christmas gatherings. We don't do our birthdays because we're a little too spread out. But there's two kind of holy days in our family. One is Thanksgiving and the other is Easter, where we really, everybody does their best to show up and be a part of it. And with Easter, it's a big production that everyone who's not married gets a basket. And this basket has to be found by following clues. But it's not just following clues. You actually have to perform some sort of feats that you are known for, whether it's gymnastics or singing a song or hitting a baseball or, you know, whatever your talents are, you have to act them out to get for your clues. It's a big deal. And so this year, my sister isn't going to be able to make it. My brother isn't going to be able to make it. It's the first time ever that other duties have called. And I was really, really sad. And my sister had sent me an email and said, we're not going to be able to make it. And I'm so sorry. And I feel so bad. And because it is my favorite day of the year. And I didn't respond to the email. I couldn't. I just felt so bummed. But I was so glad because she called yesterday and I picked up. And generally, I would be kind of more of a martyr. And when she said, you know, did you get my email? I can't come. And I go, no problem. I usually would say, no problem. Do what you can. You know, we all want to get along. But yesterday I said, I'm really sad. I really love when we're all together and I'm going to miss you and kind of hurts that you're not going to be able to make it. And I was a little worried about saying that because, again, I didn't want her to feel defensive. And so as it's so interesting how things happen at the same time, I'm thinking about what I said because I wanted to express my feelings. But then I'm trying to play out her side of it at the same time and how she may respond. And then concerned, am I creating conflict where there shouldn't be any? Or should I just let it go like we tend to let things go? And I decided to go with the feelings. And we ended up having such a great conversation just about other things that we hadn't touched on for a while, because I opened the door, I said how I felt, and she said how she felt, and we were able to go into this space. So I hung up the phone thinking, part of our Western style of communicating to maintain peace is avoidance. We'll just say no problem every time something happens, and then we'll have no problems. We'll just say, it's okay, next time, try your best, that's all right. You know, we tend to just kind of push off and say no problem, no problem. But then something small might happen, like we'll make it with not siblings, just with the marriage. And we just let things go and let things go. And then something small happens, like the toilet seat gets left up, for example. And in the middle of the night, you hit that toilet seat and it's not there. And all of a sudden the marriage is in disarray, right? Things just explode. And then it seems out of character. Why are you making such a big deal? Why is this happening? It goes back to the Daisy story. Why are you so upset about daisies? And how, when we push things away in an effort to make peace, we lose that bond of closeness. In an attempt to just try to stay friendly or to keep the peace. But if we just continually try to keep the peace or keep things friendly, we lose the depth of that relationship. We lose the potential of really opening up and sharing and feeling connected. And so there's a level of willingness to be vulnerable that has to go into our relationships in order to kind of keep them solid. And it always seems counterintuitive to say, but Some level of conflict is really important to keep things real. If we don't have conflict, then we're really not engaged in the relationship. Because the only time we're going to really have conflict is in relationships with someone we care deeply about. You know, you have to fear losing something or feel vulnerable in order to avoid conflict. If I don't care about someone, if I don't have a relationship with them, I'm not deeply connected. If I get into, you know, an argument or have conflict or they cut me off in line at the grocery store, you know, I'm not going to carry that wound forever. I'm just going to be annoyed or maybe snap and say something. But when you are truly vested in another person, when your well-being is connected to them, then conflict is going to happen because we feel vulnerable when that relationship seems to be tested. And so learning how to communicate before the conflict explodes is really an important piece of success in our relationships. And with siblings, to kind of go full circle, siblings tend to find their way back to each other, if they're going to find their way back to each other, in crisis in the family in later years. So a parent dies or a sibling dies or there's some sort of tragedy, and that kind of brings siblings together, and it's an opportunity to lower our guard or to repair past hurts. It's almost as if in the movement of our lives that the tragedies are gifts or windows to try to find our way back to relationships that we might have lost touch with at some point. And so for many siblings who have been apart or alienated from each other for years and years, coming together in the face of some sort of familial or family event or tragedy can be a moment of healing. But then conversely, as you might expect, in those moments of tragedy or the loss of a parent or the death of a sibling, it can also be the time where everything explodes and things really fall apart. And that's why it's very important for parents to help the sibling relationships to be successful. It's so important that parents are able to be very clear in their expectations of how things will be in the family while they're alive, but also after they're not here. So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. We're talking about siblings, communications, relationships, wherever you'd like to go. We're going to take a quick break, catch my breath, and come back to continue this conversation. You're listening to Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX. Don't you know they made a fine foundation? Elizabeth Baird, and this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And today we are talking about communication and siblings and how do we get along with our siblings, and if there is anything we can do as parents to try to make that sibling relationship stronger, what would that look like? Our number is 805-781-3875. Angela, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Well, I guess I'm wondering a new approach to communicate with a sibling, a brother who's just a few years older than I.
Okay.
And we've kind of had a little, we didn't have a falling out. We just stopped communicating. And I don't know, because we aren't talking and nobody else is talking. I come from a family of a very large family. I'm one of 11. I'm kid number 7. So as our parents did their best trying to raise us, everyone has a different story. They have a different dialogue and memory. Mm-hmm. And so being kind of in the middle kids, you know, we were able to band together, and it usually kind of worked in increments of 3. So my parents would take us out, you know, 3 at a time to spend time with us, if it was going to the zoo or, you know, ice capades, et cetera. But we also did big family trips and gatherings, and we had a good relationship. In the earlier years, I wasn't born yet, but my father was an alcoholic. So the older siblings have a different story to tell and definitely a different narrative. Mm-hmm. So fast forward, we did lose our mother a few years back. And after that, the one sibling that I was relatively close with at a younger age and through high school years and college years. And then I think it just hit him really hard and tragic when the loss of our mother. And after that, he just had the most tumultuous relationship with my father. And now my father's quite dependent and needs help. And he's out of the picture. And it's okay that he's out of the picture for that reason, because he's not in the position to be the caregiver. Mm-hmm. But being one of many kids, there's just a handful of us now that really step up to the plate to do the caregiving. And I have been reaching out to him via emails and some just simple little notes, nothing explaining too much, but kind of that, hi, how's it going? And so I just kind of like, well, where do we go from here? Mm-hmm. We've tried to do the family meeting, like, you know, intervention, what should we do? But I don't know. I worry that he's suffering from a lot of mental health, and the loss of our mother has really taken its toll. So, well, I've been in a drive-by dropping something off at his house.
It's such an interesting dilemma that you have, because with 11 children, you've actually, it's more of a city or, you know, a tribe than just a family in some ways. And as you said, you know, there were groups of 3 and doing outings with the parents, and each child has a whole different experience of what it was to be in that family, because when they were born into the family, depending on their position, there was, you know, things that were happening that the oldest siblings didn't experience or that the younger siblings did. And so it's not uncommon to have a sibling kind of drop out of the system. I'm actually kind of impressed that only one of 11 dropped out of the system a bit. And it could be, you know, a couple of things that are happening. One, as you said, the grief, the loss of mother that he was very close to. He might have his own alcohol issues that maybe people aren't aware of in the family or are aware of, because alcoholism tends to be very patterned and passed along. But he also might feel that it's really painful. Maybe some of the siblings remind him so much of his mother that that just brings up that pain that he's not ready to deal with as well. But I just want to encourage you to keep sending the email, you know, don't insert yourself too forcefully into his life, but to always keep that door open, so that if he is ready to reach out, you'll be a safe space. I mean, it sounds like your intuition about keeping the door open and, you know, providing him an opportunity to be part of the family and not shutting the door or not creating conflict is really a healthy way to move forward. And you're so fortunate that you have so many siblings to help and step up with your father, because I think that in itself is a real blessing, to have that many hands on deck.
Oh, yeah. Many hands make light work. But there's a few others that dropped out, but not, you know, they live right around the corner, but they're just not able or willing. And they have their own issues or concerns, and there's reasons. And You know, I'm respectful of all of them. It may not be what I want. It's exhausting for those who do come down, but we're navigating. We're figuring it out. We finally got a caregiver, and so, you know, I get to go head down next week, and I'm excited. I love my father, and I appreciate all the help we get from all the other siblings and support, and, yeah, I don't know. So I'll continue to send little notes, and,
do.
You know, I'm just... I don't know. I guess I'm not the cheerleader. I was never the fixer in the family. There was always somebody that was the fixer. Somebody's definitely the mediator in the family. Mm-hmm. So
you're going to be
the comedian.
Yeah, always. And you're going to be the welcome hands, right? Just available when people need you. And it
absolutely.
And it is interesting because in this family story, you know, everyone can only connect to the level that they're able to at certain times in their life. And to continue to have grace for that, I can hear that in your voice. It's like, well, everyone is doing the best they can at the time. And I thought it'd be so wonderful if there really was, and it doesn't exist, and I don't know how it would exist, but it'd be wonderful if there was some sort of primer, some sort of book to help children navigate the death of their parents, and instead of every sibling group is having to reinvent the wheel for their own individual story. And I think that that's would be a really amazing gift to have someone create some sort of guideline for how to navigate it. And again, I don't know how it would work because all of our personalities are so different and all of our needs are so different. But if you look at the one thing that really can stir emotions, it is the death and loss of a parent. So thank you for taking the time to call today, Angela. I appreciate you. And this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. Our number is 805-781-3875. And Brad, you got a call?
Yeah, we had a comment earlier here. And this seems to be a bit of a through line, not only just from my own personal experience, but mm-hmm. what we're getting on the phones is frequently this kind of upheaval in a family, the mm-hmm. illness or loss of a parent, and who is there to basically pick up the pieces becomes an issue. We did have a caller who said that it happened to him. He came out here to just check in on his mom, mm-hmm. ended up realizing nobody was there to take care of her out of all of his siblings, and so he ended up staying for 12 years until
wow.
she passed away. But he said he didn't receive any support from his siblings. And I've heard this before from other people in my own life about this. Well, my brothers or my sisters just can't be trusted, and I'm the one that's being left to do that. And I'm just wondering how it evolves in a family dynamic that this is decided that this is that person who's going to be the one we're just going to hand it off to, you know.
Well, and sometimes parents will make that explicit, you know. Parents do have favorites, and even if they don't recognize it, but they tend to align with certain children on certain issues. And so when it comes to the caretaking part, there is going to be a sibling that they tend to lean on. And again, would be so helpful if parents would say explicitly and not make everyone guess, here is who we're assigning to what job, because there are clearly jobs that have to happen as parents age or when they pass. And so to lay it out as much as possible would be helpful. But then sometimes it is, and again, I wonder if it's divine intervention or just a twist of fate that's strange, how many times people end up in that caregiver role they didn't expect. One of my close neighbors has been taking care of his mom for, I think, 7-8 years that was just supposed to be a visit. And it's really transformed who he is as a human being in ways that he didn't expect. And he's grown and found a lot of value in it. And then for other people, they get put in that position. There's so much resentment towards the siblings, but you can't walk away and you don't want to abandon the parents. And so it can really eat away at you. So as I said, Brad, it's a tough topic because there isn't an easy fix. And it goes back to, again, how do we utilize our communication skills that we may or may not have to try to put together relationships that work. And so one of the first things I said at the top of the show is metacommunication, that we have to communicate about what we're communicating about. Then where a lot of people get into trouble is in assuming that other people are going to get their hidden message or their mixed message. It happens in marriages a lot. It can happen in friendships and with siblings, that we will say something and then hope that the person who's listening understands or reads our mind and will respond in the way we want them to. It's kind of a setup. So I'll give an example. if I come in after a long day, you know, working at Poly and I'm tired and I walk in the door and if I say to my husband, oh, I'm home, it was a long day. But anyways, can I get you anything before I go to sit down? And if my husband is dumb enough to say, yeah, could you fix me a burger? I am going to probably get pretty upset. What do you mean? Can't you hear how tired I am? Can't you guess that I need you to have already made me food? Right? I can get really upset. If my husband's really good at reading my mind and he hears the tone of my voice, he'll jump up and say, don't worry, I already have everything for you. Let me rub your feet. That's a perfect day. But it still is rife with potential problems because I didn't walk in the door and meta communicate, I'm super tired. I had a tough day. I just need a couple minutes to catch my breath and then I'll be ready to join in. That then lets my husband know, oh, all right, I'll give her a few minutes. What can I do that's going to make it a little easier? I'll think about what we're going to talk about, or we'll both get into our best position to have a conversation. But we don't often take the time. We just kind of blurt what's happening in the moment because quite often when we feel frustrated or angry or disappointed and that knot in our stomach starts to well up and you can feel it, right? Your mouth gets dry and you're tense. And so you feel like, if I don't let this out, if I don't blurt it out, then I'm somehow going to explode or implode and hurt myself. And the opposite is true. That's the worst time to speak your mind. That is a time where we learn to count to 10. Those good old-fashioned things your mom told you. Count to 10. You know, think before you speak. All of those skills are not just cliches. They're actual communication skills that help to save relationships. But if we can catch our breath and think about, what is the intention of what I'm trying to say? Am I going to express my displeasure because I want to hurt the person I'm talking to because they hurt my feelings? Or am I expressing my displeasure because I want things to be better and I love this person and I don't want to have bad feelings? Or am I going to express my feelings just because I want to blow off steam and they can deal with it, take it for what they like? If we take a moment to catch our breath and think about what we're going to say and what our intention is, it can save us from a lot of heartache and a lot of confusion. Now, having said that, those are in our intimate relationships, our partners, our marriages, those people we sign on to spend our life with. So they have more, hopefully, vested interest in meta-communicating and taking a break and taking a step back. But when it comes to our siblings, it's a different kind of contract. We don't really even have a contract. It was just by luck of the birth that you all ended up in the same house. And so how we communicate is really kind of based on what those almost childhood relationships were like and how to, I don't know if we're trying to move past them, but we're trying to redefine them. And so one of the worst places to have a conversation with your siblings is back at the home you grew up in. Because the minute we end up back at our own house, our old house, we tend to fall back into the roles we played when we were young. For good sibling opportunities to navigate new relationships, do completely new things together. Meet at a baseball game. Meet at a park. Have an activity that you're doing together, like a shared activity. That's why siblings sometimes can come back together and do well when they're at a funeral of an aunt or uncle, or, you know, they're having to pull together. So think of that when you're trying to pull together a conversation. Don't have a conversation that's tough at a family reunion or at Christmas or at a holiday if you only see each other a few times a year. Really, if you want to rebuild your sibling relationships, you have to find a neutral territory and start from scratch. And then look for the ways that you can find common ground instead of focusing on the ways that you aren't alike at all. I don't know, Brad. What's challenging from a clinician's point of view is that one of the greatest mental health issues we have is loneliness. It's epidemic. It's more prevalent than anxiety and depression. And yet, I can sense that people who are listening who are angry at their siblings or feel betrayed by their family or feel like they are misunderstood are so rooted down in, I am not going to be the person that backs down. I haven't spoken to my sibling in 12 years. They wronged me when we were 25 and that is it. That they're so deeply rooted in that, that almost that, you know, loneliness be damned. I would rather die on my sword about this than let my sibling win.
Interesting story to share with you here. And it's not my story necessarily to tell, but it's an interesting story because it was a fascinating look at nature and nurture. My wife discovered at the age of, we'll say, mid-40s, that she had three sisters that she did not know that she had, and a dad that she did not know that she had.
Wow.
Yeah. And the fascinating thing about it was watching, meeting all of them, and watching them bring her into their sisterly group. The advantage to her is she has none of the baggage.
And no history.
And she's, by default, the oldest out of all four of them. So it's been a fascinating journey for her to connect with these sisters and to forge a relationship ahead. But it's when you talk about loneliness, she grew up for most of her life never even knowing that she had any siblings. And to watch the change in her over the years as she realized that she did have this and what that was going to mean to her, it was really interesting to see what happened and to watch them, forge this relationship. Not that it hasn't been without its perils, but coming fresh into it without any baggage was a godsend for her in that regard. So,
I know, and I guess you have in your siblings someone who's witnessed your whole life. And so you can't hide from the stories. You know, when you make friends, you can kind of fudge the stories that sound good to you. But your siblings have seen you at your best and your worst. And there's no take backs on a lot of that, a lot of those behaviors. And it also is tied into kind of our cultural narrative of, you know, the value of on being happy and, you know, we aren't going to hang on to bad or toxic relationships. And so there's a lot of permission to just kind of let go of a tie and move forward. But then on the other hand, you know, for siblings who have a brother or a sister who's gotten in trouble with drugs and alcohol or, you know, kind of fell out of the family system or really struggled themselves. And you'll hear stories quite often of siblings who all pitch in and they try to make it better and they're trying to, you know, bring them back to the fold. And then they end up just getting burnt out and it causes more struggles. It's like there never is a perfect scenario. I think at the end of the day, the whole idea of National Siblings Day is that there may be people out there that you are blood related to, your closest blood relative, and you may have nothing in common with them. And so you may have the good fortune of having siblings that you do have common ground with and that you have an ability to build closeness in a relationship and you have stories that you've shared together in your lifetime. But then you also may have been dealt this sibling group that has nothing in common at all, that they may be your closest blood tie, but you don't have anything that really links you together other than shared heritage or parenting. And so at the end of the day, we might have to forge relationships from pseudokin, those that aren't blood related, but to do the work to try to create those relationships that have that same familial bond to them. And that's really what we see a lot today is people creating forged friendships or forged family or intentional families that have been really successful. But I want to leave with this cautionary piece of it all, that it's really easy at the end of the day to love people when they're on their best behavior. And quite often, people that you're not blood related to are going to be on their best behavior more often because that relationship is not cemented in stone, that we have to be on our better behavior because they don't have to hang around. Just as in our marriages and our chosen relationships, those contracts, you know, we tend to try to be on our better behavior because, again, this person is not tied to you for life by blood. But in our sibling relationships that are there for life, that it is easy to love people when they're all on their best behavior. But I think the true measure of our maturity and our humanity is our capacity to love someone when they're not in their best space, or in spite of their foibles, or the way you felt disappointed, or the way you felt cheated. Because believe me, we could all sit down and write a list of all the ways that we feel people have disappointed us or burned us or ripped us off. And the ones that you're not related to, you've probably written off and never will see again. But the ones that you're related to, those wounds stay with you because you have that blood tie. And so it's easy to keep adding to that list and keep writing down all the ways that you feel like they ruined your life or left you, you know, high and dry. But those feelings of anger, those disappointments, those grudges with those that we are blood related to never serve us at the end of the day. Because at the end of the day, you'll come to the end of your life and they will die or you will die, and any opportunity to have been closer will be gone. And so if at all possible, I really encourage you to rethink that level of love or care. Not sacrifice your own well-being, but to keep opening the door, to let go of the grudges and the old stories, and to try to find some link, some spark, some tie. Because really, those relationships are unique, and they are your tie to your history. And it's one of the strongest ties you have. And if you can find one way to link together, it can be a magical way of healing this inherent loneliness we feel in a life that is existentially meaningless unless we create meaning in it. So you can choose to create meaning that's negative, or you can choose to create meaning that has value and history. And that's all I've got for today. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You can send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. You can find me on Instagram, Facebook, send me a message there. Listen to previous shows at kcbx.org, podcast or show, and just know that we appreciate you tuning in every Tuesday at 2 and look forward to our conversation next week right here on Central Coast Public Radio, KCBX.
So much that we need to share. So